This combination news conference briefing by Dr. Von Braun, Deputy Associate Administrator, NASA. Dr. Von Braun will make some relatively brief opening remarks as regards NASA's plans, his own new duties as they relate to those plans. He will then have some view graphs that he will discuss, and after that, a Q&A. So we would ask you, please, if you would, to hold your questions until after Dr. Von Braun finishes his presentation. Dr. Von Braun?
You can use this.
Yeah, sure. I'd like to use both of them.
Thank you, Bill. Good afternoon, gentlemen. This is my first public appearance since I assumed my new duties here at NASA headquarters as Deputy Associate Administrator for Planning. I think I first owe you an explanation on why I am here. Well, clearly, for the last 8 years, our space program, particularly our manned space flight program, had a clear-cut charter. President Kennedy and after him President Johnson had committed themselves to a lunar landing in this decade. And in my role as director of the George C. Marshall Space Flight Center in Huntsville, Alabama, it fell upon me and my associates there to take the necessary steps to develop and procure the launch vehicles for the Apollo program, the Saturn 1B and particularly the Saturn V rockets. As you all know, we have now landed two crews on the moon well within the last decade, within 1969. The agency is now confronted with the rather new situation. No longer can we coast on the momentum of a past commitment by two presidents and the United States Congress, but from now on we have to explain in far more detail to the public why we ought to have a space program and how we are going to use this newly won capability for new purposes. Now, these purposes, of course, will be predominantly in the area of science objectives and objectives in the field of practical applications for mankind. While we clearly see a lot of useful scientific and practical applications that are available to us now, due to the advances made in space, it is by no means as simple to focus these objectives as clearly as it was when we said we were going to the moon. It is quite obvious to all of you, I guess, that there's a great variety of objectives. There is competition for the available resources, and the agency has to do some very hard thinking to find out in what priority it should pursue these various objectives. So my first and maybe most important task will be to define as precisely as possible the goals and objectives of the agency. And I feel very strongly about the need for this. I think whereas going to the moon could be justified without any science objectives at all, you could simply say we want to land on the moon and we want to be there first, and this is indeed the way it was originally proposed. When it comes to goals and objectives of the agency in a broader sense, now that we've landed on the moon, we have to very carefully trade off the various advantages. I think we must, in the 1970s, clearly establish our goals and objectives as an agency first and define the hardware needed only after we know exactly what we are after. In other words, we cannot permit a situation to develop where we allow the hardware that we have on hand or the hardware that would be fine to develop to tell us where we are heading. We should first determine what the purpose of the exercise should be, why we are going there, and what precisely we are trying to accomplish there, and then decide on that basis what is needed to implement these programs. You also know that NASA has taken some rather substantial cutbacks in funding. Of course, we always expected that there would be a peak in NASA funding in the 1964-65 time period, when the projected expenditures for the Apollo program would reach their peaks, and that the NASA funding would come off a bit after this peak had been passed. But frankly, we never expected the budget to go down as low as it ultimately did, namely to the $3.3 billion, which now make up the total agency program. For this reason, my job will not be exactly simple. We are trying to maintain, as the President has promised, a viable and, in fact, imaginative and forward-looking space program, while we have a pretty hard time initiating as many or at least a substantial portion of the programs that we would like to pursue. You may have a final question, how I feel personally about coming to Washington. Well, let me say that the years in Huntsville, when I was associated with the space program there between 1960 and 1970, will undoubtedly be the finest years of my life. I never encountered such a tremendous challenge as this business of building rockets to land men on the moon. And for all the setbacks we had during that period of time, there was very rich reward in the form of successes. Now, the Earth has only one moon, and so landing a man on the moon is undoubtedly a hard act to follow. And in this respect, I'm without any illusions coming to Washington. I think my job here will be one of trying to help the administrator define the smarter space program we can develop with a reduced budget level now at our disposal. And while this is intellectually a great challenge, it will probably never match the excitement that we had in the heydays of the Apollo program. Also, with respect to my personal role, giving up a shiny NASA center in the field is a little bit like for a naval officer to give up his beloved battleship and trade it for a desk in the Pentagon. I'm fully aware of that. In fact, I have already got a little feel of this. On the other hand, there's also some reward in being associated with the powerhouse of a program like this. The nearness of the place where the decisions are made, the direct interface with the White House, the Congress, the other departments here in Washington is a very exciting experience for a man who comes in here from the colonies. Any way you look at it. I am prepared to give you a little speech here on the highlights of our 1970 objectives or the objectives of the space program during the 1970s. But before I show you the first slide, I'd like to tell you something that may be of some immediate interest. This morning, Explorer 1, the United States' first satellite, which our little team in Huntsville, together with the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, put in orbit on the 31st of January 1958, descended back into the Earth's atmosphere after a little over 12 years in orbit. It died this morning at about 6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, somewhere south of Easter Island. I thought you might be interested in this. Well, can I have the first slide, please? I'm sure you've all heard about the Apollo Application Program, a program that we initiated several years ago, and whose purpose it was to apply Apollo knowledge and Apollo hardware to new science and applications tasks. This program has now been renamed the Skylab program. It will consist of a total of four flights. The first flight will be an unmanned flight boosted by a two-stage Saturn V, only the first and second stage of a Saturn V. The third stage is replaced by what we used to call the Orbital Workshop. It is now called the Skylab. It will be this country's first orbital space station. Attached to this Skylab is an airlock module and a multiple docking adapter to which arriving command and service modules can dock for crew exchange. And also attached to it is the ATM, the Apollo Telescope Mount, or better, a manned solar observatory that will be serviced by the people living in the Skylab. One day after this Skylab has been launched into orbit and has deployed its solar panels, both on the ATM and the Skylab itself, it will be visited by a Saturn 1B launched command and service module, bringing the first crew complement of three. The command module will dock to the multiple docking adapter. The crew will slip through the docking adapter and the airlock into the workshop, which provides quarters for them. And the men will stay up there for 28 days. Now, this is about twice as long as the longest flight so far, that of Apollo 7, when Jim Lovell and Frank Borman orbited the Earth for 14 days. After the 28 days are over, the three men will crawl back into their command module, detach. They will use the service module to deboost themselves, and the command module will re-enter the ocean and make a normal Apollo landing. Then about 3 months after the first flight, another flight will go up, and this time the crew stay in the space station, in the Skylab, will be extended to 56 days, again double this amount. And finally there will be a third revisit, again of 56 days, after which the third crew will descend. The Skylab will then go into storage, and it can potentially be reactivated anytime thereafter if more revisits are planned. Next slide. Here you see the Skylab in a little more detail. Here's the command and service module docked to the multiple docking adapter. Here's the airlock. And down here is the Skylab itself. This is the ATM, the Apollo Telescope Mount, and this windmill-shaped array of solar cells provides electric power, about 5 kilowatts, to the ATM. And these big flaps here provide approximately the same amount of energy for the housekeeping functions in the in the Skylab itself. Next slide. Now, here's just one of the many new things that we will introduce here. You see, we have a rather down-to-earth problem even up in the sky. The problem here was the development of a toilet that would work under zero gravity. Next slide. This Skylab will be this country's first space station. We hope it will be succeeded by a modularized space station, which will come next. This station will in all likelihood have 33 feet in diameter, and each module will be capable of accommodating a total of 12 people. These modules can be stacked together, and the station can grow as more modules are brought up. Here again are the solar panels for power supply, and this is a typical instrument module for observation. Here you see already a shuttle vehicle, such as we envision to fly the logistics up to such a space station. I will come to this a little later. Next slide. This is a typical operations deck in the second generation space station. All these stations will have a central tunnel through which the various decks are connected. These tunnels are a combination of a corridor and an air raid shelter, and also a radiation shelter for sensitive materials such as photographic film. Typical height of such a deck is 8 feet, and typical diameter is 33 feet. Depending on the utility of such an operations deck, the distribution of the spaces inside will differ. Next slide. Now, I mentioned already in passing the shuttle. This is, of course, one of the most exciting, at the same time also one of the most difficult problems the agency is about to tackle. In the Saturn V, just as an example here, we have used the technique of throwing all our stages away as we go to orbit and onto the moon, and this of course is a very costly operation. So the idea has occurred, for very obvious reasons, can one not build a completely reusable vehicle that can fly into orbit and return like an airplane so that it can be refueled and fly again and do that maybe 100 times? Well, with presently available propellants, including liquid hydrogen, any idea of building a one-stage-to-orbit vehicle doesn't look very attractive. I'm not saying that it cannot be done, but our studies indicate that all these designs are so marginal with respect to their weight assumptions that it could very easily be that you lose all your payload if you just make a minor little mistake. And we just don't know enough about these vehicles to really be able to say that present technology permits building a one-stage vehicle with an attractive payload. So all our studies indicate that we probably need a two-stage vehicle, and a typical example would be a big glider carrying its own propulsion system, to which a smaller glider carrying again its own propulsion system would be side-strapped. The unit takes off vertically, like a Saturn V, and at about Mach number 6, the propellant tanks in the first stage will be depleted. At this point, the reusable booster would simply peel off, and the reusable orbiter would be ignited. Only the reusable orbiter would reach orbit. It will get into orbit with payload and enough propellant left to deboost itself back into a flight into the atmosphere, where an aerodynamic type landing would be performed. Now, using a reusable booster is, of course, only one way of approaching this objective. Another would be that you say, let's not go all out, let's just have a reusable orbiter. And here you could do various things. For example, you can have a returnable airplane-type spacecraft that is boosted to orbit, either with an all-solid booster or with something like, for example, a Titan to which a number of solids are strapped. The Titan core itself can be a two-stage vehicle. In this case, you would be talking about a throwaway booster with a reusable orbiter. And you can do the same thing even using some of the stages of the Saturn V to get up the speed and concentrate only on a maneuverable, reusable spacecraft. It is still too early to say whether this route or this route, the completely reusable system or this route, would be chosen. Clearly, on a recurrent cost basis, anything completely reusable would be more cost effective. Once you have such a beast, you can maybe make one flight for something like $5 million, of which about one half will probably be the amortization of the initial machine. The machine that you have to build, if the machine makes, for example, only 100 flights, it must be thrown away after 100 flights, but it cost you $200 million to build, and you would have to amortize $2 million per flight. Vehicles of this kind will undoubtedly be more costly to launch just because you throw more away, but the initial bulk of money to develop such a machine will be a fraction of what it costs to do this. And so one of our crucial questions that we are presently wrestling with in the agency is, can the traffic that we can expect for the next 10, 15 years, would the traffic that we can expect in the next 10, 15 years justify an initial multi-billion dollar investment to develop such a machine? And can we hope to get enough return on the dollar out of a sufficient number of flights to really justify this kind of an investment? Or would we be smarter off to go only halfway and have a reusable orbiter and stick to throwaway stages for the time being and bite this off only later? There's also an aspect of feasibility involved in this. Quite a few people seem to believe that it would just simply be smarter to start with a smaller spacecraft and use this to learn how to build a reusable spacecraft rather than bite off the very much more difficult task of building a machine the size of a Boeing 747 to get a, like this one here, to get some usable payload in orbit. The next slide shows that among the many completely reusable configurations that we are studying, even there's a vast variety. I don't want to go into all the details and identify these details with any particular contractor names, but you see that there are, for example, a trimaran configuration here. Then there is a vehicle here that has a catamaran type booster and a delta glider that nestles in it. Then you have a vehicle here with straight wings that has not nearly the cross range capability than this vehicle would have, but maybe a little simpler to develop. And even these come in various configurations. So I'd like to leave you with the thought that the two fundamental decisions, A, will we have a half reusable shuttle where the boost stages are discardable and only the spacecraft is reusable? Or will we go all out and have a completely reusable two-stage system? This question has not been answered yet. And after it will be answered, the next question is, which of these many configurations for a completely reusable vehicle or a half-reusable vehicle will be the most attractive. Next slide, please. Well, this chart here shows how a completely reusable vehicle would work in principle. I think pretty obvious. The booster peels off here, makes a high angle of attack re-entry. It has aerodynamic cruise engines that enable it to fly back to the launch site. The orbiting vehicle goes all the way into orbit. First, 100 nautical mile orbit. It can then make a Hohmann transfer and go into a higher orbit, where it can stay up to 7 days. It can then return back into the atmosphere, make its re-entry. The orbiting vehicle does not need air-breathing engines because you can time your departure from orbit in such a way that the landing area rolls on the rotating Earth into your footprint area as you leave the orbit. There's still some question with respect to the need for go-around capability, or at least an ability to modulate your glide angle, so maybe some power for the terminal phase, something sometimes called instant delta, instant L over D, something that the pilot can call in to pull himself towards the runway. That's still under discussion. Next slide, please. Regardless of whether the booster is reusable or not, the upper end, the orbiting element, will probably look something like this. Now, this is a configuration that would give us cross range, which seems to be desirable for some applications. If it has no cross range, it may feature straight wings instead. Now, such a space shuttle can be used for a number of applications. You can either fly lots of people up into orbit, and here the crucial novelty about this vehicle will, of course, be that the astronauts, in our present sense of the word, are confined to the cockpit. They are your airliner crew, and the men in the back can be scientists who need not have any more medical qualification than an airline passenger. Now, with such a shuttle, by just replacing the passenger compartment by a cargo compartment, you can now, for example, deliver propellant into orbit, which may be a good thing to do if you want to go with a nuclear vehicle, say, onto the moon or the planets, and you want to replenish it with liquid hydrogen Earth orbit before it takes off. Or you can go up to a satellite that has broken down or should be updated. Now, this is a pretty important consideration. When we use the word repair, we actually mean repair and modification. Let me say a word about this. For example, if you have a solar observatory or a stellar observatory in space that costs a lot of money to build, you may want to add other instruments to the light output end of this thing that you couldn't think about when the thing was first sent up into orbit, because in the meantime somebody may have discovered some new celestial phenomenon like a quasar or a pulsar, and some scientists would say, gee, if we could only attach these instruments to that satellite that's already in orbit, to that orbital observatory, we could do a lot of interesting things. So the shuttle could visit it and pull it back into the cargo bay, where in a pressurized environment the necessary rework could be done. Should it exceed the scope of what can be done in orbit, it can also conceivably take the entire payload down into the cargo bay and carry it back to Earth and give it to the factory so that the factory can do the changes. Now, wherever short stay times, say up to 2 weeks, are sufficient to fly a scientific mission, the shuttle itself can actually use as serve as a temporary space station. It has the advantage, of course, that some scientists may want to have a particular orbit where there happens to be no space station, and if he can do his job in 2 weeks, why not do it right out of the shuttle? Deployment of satellites is another thing. So far, we send satellites into orbit and then expose them to what you might call an activation phase, where solar panels are deployed and antennas come out and the attitude system is activated and sensors are activated and the data system is activated. And if any one of these activations don't work, you may have a a piece of orbital junk there that doesn't do anybody any good. Now, if you hang on to your satellite after you carry it in orbit, stick it out on an arm, maybe with a swivel mount at the end, you can now deploy your panels and your stick your antennas out and activate your sensors and your data systems and so forth and see whether everything works well. And you would detach your shuttle from the satellite only after you know that all systems are go. This would do away with this formidable activation barrier that has cost us quite a few of unmanned spacecraft in the past. Well, finally, you can carry in your shuttle, in the cargo compartment, a propulsive stage which may carry a smaller unmanned satellite in its nose, which you can now send up, say, to synchronous orbit or to the moon or to the planets. So the shuttle could conceivably rake up quite a little bit of traffic along those lines. Next slide, please. Well, another NASA objective for the early 70s is, of course, the continuation of the series of Mariner flights, particularly to the planet Mars. And for 1971, the agency has Mariner H and I on tap. Both will orbit Mars. So far, we had only Mars flybys. Now, this is a pretty important step in the right direction. As you all know, the disadvantage of a flyby, for all its simplicity, it doesn't have to provide a lot of delta V when it gets to a planet. For all this simplicity, the useful scientific time of a flyby is very limited. For example, in the two previous Mariners, F and G, that flew to Mars in 1969, we had a total science time of, I would say, really less than an hour on both combined. Now, some photographs were taken further away, but the real interesting topographic photographs taken of Mars were actually taken during a few critical minutes when the flyby probe was close enough to the planet to give us high resolution. Of course, when you put something in orbit, it's an entirely different game. No longer are you limited to just one small swath of the planet that you can map accurately. I think F and G together mapped something like 1% of Mars' surface. But you can now hang that thing in orbit around Mars and let the planet rotate around its axis underneath, and you can conveniently map the whole planet, and you get weeks and possibly months out of useful science time. So, whereas from the standpoint of rocketry and maybe even spacecraft, it doesn't look like much of a step ahead to go to an orbiter in 71 when we had flybys in 69 and even earlier, we feel that as far as the science output is concerned, this will be a real quantum job. We may indeed get maybe 100 times as much topographic information and atmospheric information on the planet than we did in the previous ones. This program is again handled out of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Next slide. After Mariner H and I, the agency plans to send a Viking spacecraft to the planet Mars. Now, this is a substantially heavier vehicle that will require probably a Titan III Centaur type launch vehicle. This vehicle can not only orbit Mars, but it can peel off a segment of the orbiting spacecraft that can perform an aerodynamic landing on Mars and a soft touchdown. After touchdown of the landed units, the orbiting element will remain in orbit and serve as a kind of a communications relay for messages radioed up from the landed station. As you all know, the planet Mars has an atmosphere, so prudent use is made of atmospheric drag deceleration. There will be a heat shield, but the atmosphere is so thin that our parachute deployment has to begin at much higher speeds than on Earth. And finally, at the end, shortly before touchdown, some propulsive maneuver is necessary to kill the remaining radar descent to enable the unit to perform a soft touchdown. So what you actually see here is a landing sequence that mixes Apollo technology, slowing down via heat shield and subsequent parachute deployment, with a LEM type landing technology to land on the rocket power. Next slide, please. I forgot to mention that it was originally planned to fly these Vikings to Mars in 1973, but budget consideration forced the agency to postpone this attempt to the next opportunity, namely 1975. Well, another very exciting program is the so-called Grand Tour. During the period of 19... 19-